Weather forecasters say substantial rain is on the way, offering at least some temporary relief for firefighters. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has an update on this season's firefighting costs so far. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the CEO of a tribal company in the process of buying Kerr Dam. National Weather Service meteorologist Leanne Allegretto describes an incoming weather system as a potential resetting event, one that could, at least temporarily, give firefighters in parts of western Montana a much-needed break. The technical term for this sort of wet, slow-moving weather event is a cutoff low. Allegretto says thunderstorms will start to develop across central Idaho and southwest Montana.
And then throughout the night and into tomorrow, the thunderstorms are going to spread northward and become more widespread. The good news is with these thunderstorms that they're going to be predominantly wet thunderstorms. And what I mean by that is that they should dump some good rain. But then once the thunderstorms shift northward, then it's going to turn into more of a steady, moderate to heavy rainfall type of system. And I think if you're around the Interstate 90 corridor and north, you're going to get some pretty good rain amounts. And I was actually just working on them, and we're looking at about 3/4 inch in and around the Missoula and Bitterroot Valleys, and up to an inch to an inch and a half as you go towards like Libby, West Glacier, and Eureka.
The thunderstorms may not produce as much rain in southwest Montana, which raises concerns about the aftermath of the lightning strikes. Allegretto says temperatures in west central and northwest Montana will drop as the system moves through.
Tomorrow, they should be a little cooler than today, but not at their worst. Right around the mid to upper 70s for Thursday. And then for Friday, temperatures are going to cool down into the mid to upper 60s in most places. Now, if people are going to Glacier National Park or if they're going up into the backcountry, they'll see temperatures in the upper 40s to mid 50s. So it's going to be really chilly. And combined with rain, very raw.
Temperatures will gradually moderate back into the 70s by Saturday and the 80s by Sunday. Next week's temperatures should comfortably range from the low to mid 80s.
Progress continues to be made on the Firestone Flats fire near Arlee. That 1,750-acre fire now stands at 60% containment. Fire Information Officer Steve Till says all evacuees are now back in their homes.
We're real happy to be able to do that. We understand folks are anxious and worried, and so that's really good news. Of course, only residents and emergency services folks are allowed in. It's still dangerous for other people to be driving up and down the road with all the fire service people in there.
Burnout operations continued on the northeast end of the fire today. Good news from the 8-acre Butte Cabin Fire 25 miles southeast of Missoula. Lolo National Forest spokesman Boyd Hartwig says crews have that small blaze all but buttoned up.
And firefighters had pretty good results building fire line and getting that lined. Yesterday helped a lot with the cooler temps and higher humidity, and fire behavior was pretty minimal yesterday.
The Moose Meadows fire southeast of Phillipsburg is listed at 3,100 acres with 10% containment. Spokesman Ted Pettis says the eastern flank continues to show strong activity, but the western edge is coming along nicely.
We've got completed line that we've secured, and we've began some mop-up operations around the perimeter of it, where we're actually going inside the perimeter of the fire about 100 feet from our fire line and pretty much 100% extinguishing everything in there, stump poles and old burning logs, and snagging it and trying to put the final security on it in that short perimeter there.
All evacuations remain in effect on the Moose Meadows fire.
Montana State Forester says the state's fund for fighting wildfires still has the vast majority of the money provided to it by the 2013 legislature. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us more about wildfire costs this year and what changes the state has been making and how it pays those bills.
I think we're doing relatively well, certainly compared to last year.
State Forester Bob Harrington says the state is sitting at a little less than $2 million in estimated fire costs so far in 2013. That's out of a wildfire suppression fund Harrington predicts somewhere in the $20 million range. Historically, the state used to pay for fire costs retroactively, after they were already done. But after a very expensive fire year in 2007, the legislature in a special session created the Wildfire Suppression Fund. That $40 million in one-time money lasted until last year. This year, the legislature put more money back in, but then also changed the method. The governor's budget director, Dan Villa, says the state now will have a permanent source of money to fight wildfire.
We will have an ongoing mechanism to make deposits into the fire suppression account, as well as a mechanism to mitigate high-risk fire areas.
Villa says extra money not spent by state agencies and some corporate license tax money will go into the fund. He says the first deposit using this new method will happen mid-August and should bring the fund up to about $50 million. A little more than 800 fires have been reported as of the end of July, burning 43,000 acres. State Forester Harrington says the $2 million cost to the state does not reflect most of the cost of fighting these fires that will be shouldered by federal and tribal agencies. Still, compare that $2 million with totals from last year, where the state spent about $55 million on wildfires. 2012 was a particularly active fire year. Despite the short-term rainy forecast, Harrington says we still have a lot left in this fire season. He says conditions remain extreme in southwest and south-central Montana.
If you just pay attention to statistics, the next 2 to 3 weeks are really going to be the driver on just the challenges that the fire service faces, as well as ultimately what the costs are going to be.
He says on average about 50% of fire starts come from lightning, the other half from humans. Fire agencies are constantly working on public relations campaigns to try to lower that second half.
Try to remind the public that no matter what they're doing, one of the things that they should think about is whatever activity I'm engaged in, does it have the potential to start a fire?
In 2012, the state was still battling large wildfires into late September. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a Washington state man has pleaded not guilty to beating and stabbing to death his 3-year-old son in a southwestern Montana field. Jeremy Kramer of Lacey was arraigned today in district court in Anaconda, about 5 miles from where Broderick Kramer's body was found July 9th. The 38-year-old Kramer, wearing a black and white striped jumpsuit and orange sandals, spoke only once to answer Judge John Larson, affirmatively, that he understood his rights. Public defender Walter Hennessy entered an initial not guilty plea, telling Larson he didn't want to prejudice any possible defenses. After the 5-minute hearing, Kramer was escorted back to the Anaconda Deer Lodge jail, where he is being held on $250,000 bail. Prosecutors say Kramer told his father in a rambling jailhouse phone call that he killed his son.
If all goes as planned, in September 2015, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes will be the first tribes in the country to own a major hydroelectric facility. The tribes obtained the option to pursue buying Kerr Dam near Polson in 1985 and have been working towards that goal ever since. Last fall, they formed a corporation known as Energy Keepers Incorporated to finalize the purchase from PPL Montana and to ultimately take over the dam's operation. In tonight's feature interview, CEO Brian Lipscomb talks about the history of Kerr Dam, the plan to purchase it, and the new tribally owned company he heads that will be in charge of operating it.
Or in Salish and Kootenai, it's Swinkaels Ulsowechim, and in Kootenai, it's Kusukliomumal Alkalmokwaets. So those words are the latter of those two word or those two phrases stands for lightning, because that's the closest thing we had to energy in the two languages, and then the word in front of it is those who care for it. Because when we name things, we try to name the group of people of what they're doing for the tribe. So
it translates to those who care for...
Yeah, those who care for the energy, mm-hmm. For the rest of the people. So closest thing in English is energy keepers.
And this is a corporation that's been formed for the sole purpose of overseeing the purchase of Kerr Dam and then the operation of that facility.
Yeah, that's correct. It's established for acquiring the facility and operating it, so we're in the process right now of starting up that corporation to do just that. So we're chasing personnel and pursuing staffing for the operations of the facility. We've got 4 operator trainees right now that are training at PPL Montana facilities, both at Kerr and at facilities in Great Falls, and going through a apprenticeship program to become licensed hydropower operators. And then we've got others that we're pursuing as well in the plant management arena. And then we've got power marketing coordinator who's in a training program at Bonneville Power Administration, over in Portland. So learning the ins and outs of power marketing, that'll be another major part of what we do as we take over the facility. And then the business structure is being assembled as well.
The purchase of the dam really kicked off in 1985, didn't it, when the tribes negotiated the relicensing of the dam with what was then Montana Power and basically became a co-licensee.
Yes, yes, that's correct.
With the option to buy the dam down the road.
Yes. So in 1985, you may recall there was a relicensure of Kerr Dam. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issues licenses for privately held hydropower facilities across the country, and they're typically 50-year licenses. So the first license for Kerr was issued in 1930. That expired, of course, in 1980. And in 1976, both Montana Power Company and the tribes filed for relicensure of the facility. So the tribes filed a competing license application. Through 9 years of negotiation then, till 1985, the tribes and the Montana Power Company came to settlement. And that settlement entailed an increase in the land rental charge. So the Federal Power Act allows for Indian tribes who have facilities such as this built on their lands to get land rental for the use and occupancy of their land, which, of course, Kerr sits on tribal land, uses tribal resources. In 1980, at the time of the expiration of the first license, we were receiving about $4.5 million per year in land rental charge. We had economists that told us at the time that that was not near adequate, that we should be receiving about half of the revenue from the facility since we owned half the reservoir, half the storage reservoir, and it sat on our property.
Flathead land.
Yes, that's right. So that was estimated in 1985 at about $25 million. So we approached Montana Power Company and said, look, why don't you sell us the facility first instead? So after 9 years of back and forth, I'll really summarize it shortly, they said, how about we give you a lesser lease? We pay you a lesser lease up front for the opportunity to buy the facility at original cost construction, less depreciation, and you get that opportunity for the latter 20 years of the license. And in addition, we'll provide you some training so you get prepared to operate it 5 years prior to that time, which is 2015. So the tribe said, sure, we'll take that deal. It made sense to us because we get opportunity to buy the facility that we wanted to. We did get an increase in lease, not as much as we'd hoped for, but we recognized that it was an opportunity to get the asset acquired.
It's about $19 million a year now, right?
So that lease has increased. So we negotiated to $9 million, as I said, and that's increased to $19 million per year now, and then it'll continue to increase over time. And Energy Keepers will continue to pay that lease back to the tribe as well for the use and occupancy of the lands.
Once you own.
That's right. That's right.
To go back even further, when the dam was first constructed, the tribes didn't want the dam there. It was built basically to supply power to the mining operations in Butte and smelting in Anaconda.
That's correct.
And the tribes objected because they felt an infringement on a cultural resource of the falls.
That's right. Yeah. So it's always good and important to start out a conversation about Kerr from a tribe's perspective, that it is built on a very significant cultural site and natural resource site. And of course, the impacts to that are profound. The falls that was there is no longer there. It's underwater. So the impacts are irreversible from that perspective. You know, there's enough alteration of the landscape there that a lot of it's changed. So, it was originally constructed in that era, and it's important to realize that that was an era that people really thought the Flathead Indian Reservation was going to go away. Keep in mind, it was right at the end of the allotment era for reservations across the country. Not just the Flathead, but others were impacted by an assimilation policy of the federal government, whereby they allotted the lands, gave them away to individual tribal members, and then what was left was opened up for homesteading, at least on the Flathead Indian Reservation. So there's this, you know, huge land grab that had gone on and taken place from about 1910 through the 1920s. And Kerr was part of that. You know, Montana Power Company came into the picture as part of that opening up of the reservation. It was associated with the construction of the irrigation project across the reservation, which was also part of the allotment, because if you had irrigation, you could have more allotments because you could have smaller parcels of property that would meet the agricultural economic benefit standard that was established for how big an allotment needed to be. So if you irrigated the land, you could make smaller ones. If you had smaller ones, you'd make more of them. So they started constructing the irrigation project along with the allotments in order to assure that a portion of the irrigation project worked, the north part of it in the Mission Valley. They had to assure that Pablo Reservoir would fill every year, because it won't just from gravity. So it requires pumping, and they were planned to pump out of the Flathead River at the time, and so the federal government actually started the original project there. We're just going to build a series of tunnels. They were going to be called the Newell Tunnels, and it was going to be a run-of-the-river facility. It was just going to provide power to the city of Polson and those pumps. So Montana Power Company comes on the scene and says, "You're not thinking big enough. We'll build a dam. We'll give you the power you need for the running the pumps, and we'll take the rest." So, of course, that's how Kerr Dam got started.
That's what happened, yeah. So why, after all these years, Brian, do the tribes want to own the dam?
Well, first of all, it sits on our reservation, on our property, uses our resources. So it'll be the first opportunity in 80 years that we'll have control of our own resources again, Flathead Lake and the lower Flathead River. So that's primary, and of course it's an important cultural site that we'll have physical control back of that we haven't had for 80 years. Although it is tribal lands, we don't have physical control of it because it's part of the license. It's within the license parameters itself, so we don't control that at the moment. So we'll have those two things back. And in addition, it's a great opportunity for economic income for the tribe. So although we do get a lease payment now, which, as you said, has escalated to about $19 million, when you look backwards over time at the market compared to the output, that's not near what the tribes could have made over the past 25 years if they would have owned it. So there's that opportunity as we look to the future. We hope that it's provides economic benefit to the tribe. And then finally, it creates opportunity for employment. Hopefully, we'll have about 20 or so employees, and I'm optimistic that several of those will be tribal members. And they'll be good, you know, family-supportable wages associated with those jobs.
This deal is to be completed in September of 2015.
That's correct. Yeah.
And in your opinion, it will happen, but the price that you will pay for the dam is still under arbitration, correct? PP&L Montana now owns the dam, and they are asking more for the dam than the tribes think is fair.
That's correct. So currently, we've disputed the original cost construction less depreciation cost estimate that PP&L Montana has given us. Part of the deal that we negotiated in 1985 that we spoke of earlier included provisions for how the sale would take place. So the company was to provide us an estimate of OCLD in September of 2010. They did that. It was around $54 million or so. And then they were to provide us an updated conveyance price in September of 2012. So they did that. And it was around $51 million, and I think it's 51.6. The tribes then, if we didn't agree, we had opportunity to dispute. So we disputed that price. Then we had opportunity to negotiate. These are all opportunities spelled out in the license. So we negotiated with PP&L Montana. We failed to reach a settlement. So we took advantage of an opportunity to petition for arbitration. So we did that, filed that demand for arbitration in December. And we've asserted that the price should be more like around $16
million. 16.
Yeah. And the primary difference between PP&L Montana's estimate for original cost less depreciation and ours is that they've included the depreciated costs for mitigation of the resources impacted by the facility, which, of course, are tribes' resources. So they've included those costs, which are normally considered operating costs and not considered capital, in their estimate. So we've disputed that. There are several other provisions of the license and provisions of the accounting standards that also indicate that it should not be included.
Are you confident that despite this dispute over the selling price, that this will be negotiated and there won't be a point where you say, well, the deal's off?
Well, you'd never want to say there's going to be a point where the deal's off, because obviously you can't completely see into the future. Who knows? Maybe there's a big earthquake and something happens and we wouldn't want it right before we take over. But if we're on the current track we're on, Sally, even if we had to pay 51.6 and we lost an arbitration, we'd still proceed. That's not the market value of the facility by any means, but it's not what we negotiated in 1985 either. So, we're confident that we're going to proceed one way or the other.
And September 2015 would be quite a month for the tribes. You would be the first tribes in the country, I believe, to own a major hydroelectric dam.
That's correct. We'll be the first tribe in the nation to be the sole owner of a major hydroelectric facility. There are other tribes that are on similar paths to ours that will become majority owners or owners in the future, but it's out beyond 2015. So yeah, we're pretty excited about that date in history for us. It'll be a watershed moment, if you will, for us.
Come full circle in some ways.
And that fits with our history as a tribe. We've been pretty aggressive at trying to take control of our own destiny. In 1934, we were the first tribe in the nation to become recognized under the Indian Reorganization Act. We've been the first tribe in the nation to become a contractor with the Bureau of Indian Affairs for all of the programs that are provided for the tribes. And then we've moved on to an even more independent relationship with the federal government there and moved to what's called compacting. So we've taken advantage every opportunity that we've had to take control of our own resources and our own destiny as a people. So this just fits right in with that.
We have been speaking with Brian Lipscomb, who's CEO of Energy Keepers, Inc., which is the tribal corporation that is in the process of purchasing and then operating Kerr Dam. Brian, thanks so much for giving us both the history lesson and the status update on that effort. Thank you.
You bet.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight I expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be in the mid-70s to lower 80s. For central Montana, tonight will be cloudy and have a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms with lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be in the upper 70s to 80s. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and lows around 45 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy, rain showers, and a chance of thunderstorms are likely. Some thunderstorms may be severe. Highs will be in the upper 70s to 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Sherry Sheehy Moe.
It's strange to me that I know so many parents now who have a child with a debilitating illness. It's strange because throughout my own school years, I was aware of only one classmate who was chronically ill. And in 18 years of teaching high school students, I recall only two with chronic illness. Yet over the course of the last 15 years, I've come to know the parents of at least a dozen such children. Children with diabetes, cystic fibrosis, leukemia, and more. Maybe the increase in autoimmune disease has increased the numbers of children with chronic disease. Or maybe my own work with healthcare issues has increased my awareness. Probably, though, it's because a couple of women I love
have children they love who have those diseases. And knowing their experience opened the door to my meeting more and more of these remarkable women. If you don't know such women, watch As Good As It Gets. There's that one scene when Carol, the mom of a chronically ill son, finally sees that there actually is a way to get Spencer the support system he needs. But even though her son doesn't require the constant vigilance he used to, Carol just can't relax. She just can't stop feeling what she calls that stupid panic thing inside me all the time. I've seen that panic, but praise God, I've not experienced it. I've seen the mom with a three-ring binder detailing what has happened, what could happen, and what should happen, urgently pressing teachers, aides, and bus drivers to read the material, know it, master it. I've met the mom who pleads with teachers, can I meet with the other children? Can I tell them the signs that mean Henry's in trouble? I've seen the mom trying to be pleasant, professional with school administrators about her daughter's illness, but then her voice catches, her eyes fill with tears, and wordlessly she pushes the bulging folder of information across the table. That panic thing is inside them all the time, but it's not a stupid panic. One of them can calculate carbs like a math whiz and give you an hour-by-hour reading of her son's glucose level. Another can reel off the names of 10 different medications, treatments, and procedures her daughter needs throughout the day and how they might need to be modified at a moment's notice. Yet another knows more than you want to hear about fecal incontinence and how to prevent it. These women are all master students on their children's illnesses. But when they try to educate the folks at school, sometimes they get the feeling the school doesn't care. Sometimes a teacher will say, I've got 23 other children in this classroom. I'm sorry, but I just can't meet all the needs of your child. Sometimes a school official will advise, it's best not to single your child out to make her feel different. We try to treat all children the same. And indeed, sometimes for long stretches of time, these children look and act the same as other children, but they aren't. Any number of factors at school could jeopardize their lives. The cafeteria could change the school lunch from corn dogs to spaghetti, and the carefully calculated carb count goes out the window. The child across the aisle could come to school with a bad cold and endanger the little girl whose medications have suppressed her immune system. The lunchroom supervisor may know that certain foods have ingredients that could put that boy in anaphylactic shock, but the art teacher may not know that her art materials have the same ingredients. That's why Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act exists. In 1973, Congress recognized that children with disabilities are not the same, except in one fundamental way. They have the same right to a free, appropriate public education that all children do. Section 504 requires that when a student has a disability that affects a major life activity, schools work with parents and health care providers to identify and implement reasonable accommodations. 40 years after the passage of the Rehabilitation Act, the range of accommodations schools offer children is impressive. Everything from stop-the-clock testing to a seat closest to the bathroom, and from administering medication and cleaning pick lines to allowing snacks several times a day. Parents work with school personnel to make sure they know warning signs and how to respond. Schools send tutors and materials to the home when the child has an extended absence. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I often marvel at the good things our public schools do, and the process of developing and implementing a 504 plan that really works is truly a marvel. There's an alliance there between parents and educators that is driven entirely by a shared concern for the child and a commitment to anticipating problems and identifying solutions. That's the way we should approach the education of all children. No, a good 504 plan doesn't make that panic thing inside disappear, but it does make it seem manageable. If you feel your child has a health issue that is affecting his or her education, contact your school district's Section 504 coordinator. They're there to help. This is Mary Shihimo, retired, but still advocating for free quality public education in Montana.
I apologize, I mispronounced tonight's commentator's name. It's Mary Sheehy Moe, not Sherry Sheehy Moe.
Mary Sheehy Moe is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. Views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.